Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. John Singleton Copley painted the portraits of some of Boston's most famous revolutionaries and founding fathers, John Hancock, Paul Revere, John Adams, Samuel Adams. Jane Kamensky says that's one of the reasons Copley is considered a quintessential great American painter.
In the United States, and especially in New England, we have, I think, what can only be called a nationalistic claim on him. There's a mind's eye picture of America that goes to his work and his particular kind of realism.
But there's a twist. The painter who so ably captured the spirit of revolutionary America may not have considered himself American at all. That's one of the questions at the heart of Jane Kamensky's new book, A Revolution in Color, The World of John Singleton Copley. We met up with Kamensky recently at the Harvard Art Museum to talk about Copley's life and see some of his portraits. She told us he was born on July 3rd, 1738, the son of Irish immigrants to Boston, which at the time was a hub of shipping activity on the periphery of the British Empire. Kamensky also says Copley became an artist almost by accident.
The likeliest ingredient is that when his mother, who was long widowed, remarried, Copley was 10, she happened to marry somebody who was a portraitist and engraver. And he had tools. Peter Pelham, Copley's stepfather, only was in Copley's life for 3 years. Copley was 10 when Pelham joined the family, or when the family combined, and 13 when Pelham died. So to the extent there was an art scene in Boston, it came home to Copley for three of the years that any lower middling boy would have been seeking a trade.
This is always one of the things that fascinates me so much about, you know, 17th and 18th century portraitists who we now consider great artists, is that they very much have a story like Copley's.
Yes, it's you know, it's not a lowly trade. It's not working the docks, although he grew up on the docks.
Yeah.
Lower middling, I would say. You know, he writes a quite famous letter where he says one of the things that make him want to get out of this provincial world is that the arts are no more esteemed than trades like shoemaking.
Well, I mean, since we're standing in front of three of his works, can we talk about them?
Yeah.
We have so three Boylstons here, right?
So this is a trio of family portraits with the mother in the center and two brothers flanking her on either side. It's a mercantile family, which is exactly the kind of family that wanted themselves commemorated in portraiture. They're all a very, very high level of finish, almost as if Copley was holding up a mirror to his subjects. There's a real sort of warts and all unidealized quality to the way that Copley captures faces. You know, I think one of the questions about his early career is, how does he paint better than anything he's ever seen?
Uh-huh.
And he does. So all three of these have that hyper-realistic quality. The fabrics are especially vivid. Like, you almost want to touch Nicholas Boylston's gown and see if the damask feels raised or flocked. You can see the older Mrs. Boylston's faint mustache.
Do you know why one of her hands is gloved and the other isn't?
It's giving her something to do.
Okay.
You know, she's holding a glove. It's showcasing his excellence with fabric and with hands. But if you look closely at Mrs. Boylston's arm, there's a big anatomical flaw in the portrait. She looks like she's about to pull off her left forearm and beat you with it, right? I think one interesting thing that these canvases show is there's no drawing school in Boston, normal social interaction that would let you stare at a nude model. So when he's rendering anatomy, he's working with a figure. He, you know, one of those little jointed wooden figures. One of the first things he does for himself, he's copying medical illustration books. He's copying a plaster copy of a marble copy of the Venus de Milo. That's the kind of game of telephone of the arts. So when you see a painter who is this skilled not being able to attach an arm to the body, it tells us something about the conditions of production there.
So around the time that he was painting these portraits, I see this one is 1767 here. I mean, who were Copley's artistic contemporaries, and what made him really stand out from them?
His early life is marked by a series of tragedies. His father dies, his stepfather dies. The best artist in Boston, who's an Edinburgh-trained portraitist named John Smybert, also dies. So there's not a lot of artistic means around him. But this also creates space so that when the Seven Years' War happens, and a lot of people from the empire are using Boston as a hub of provisioning, of battle planning, of place seeking, and office holding, and sort of strategies for climbing the rungs of the empire. Portraiture is one of those strategies. Picture of yourself wrapped in red. He's the best thing in town by accident. He's still a teenager, and there's nobody around really crafting this trade that can compete with him.
He was so young when he was doing these paintings.
He was so young, yeah. I mean,
That's amazing.
And this is another part of the lower middling echelon, is that when his stepfather dies and he's 13, he's got a mother who is 50, sells a little tobacco. He's got a half-brother who is 3. He's got need. So by 15, he has a practice in portraiture where people who are not family members are coming and paying him. And by the time he's 20, he's done something that none of his male kin have done in the so-called New World. He's bought a house.
Wow. Now, do I have this right that he has a family connection to the Tea Party, the Boston Tea
Party?
Yes,
so, at the time that these portraits were painted, it's sort of in the middle of the long run of up and down imperial tensions. So 1767, it's a relatively calm moment when he's doing these portraits. Flare up with the occupation of Boston in 1768, calms down again. Flare up with the massacre, even after the so-called massacre, calms down again. So when the Tea Act is passed in 1773, various merchants in Boston think, this is a fantastic economic opportunity. You know, instead of competing with the smugglers, I can get a license to sell this soft drug. And one of the people who succeeds in getting those licenses is Copley's father-in-law. So he marries a political identity that could not possibly have been foreseen when he made what I've described as the most deliberate and important choice of his life, approaching the altar in 1769. So when the tea ships sail into Boston in December of 1773, it's Copley's father-in-law's tea. And the kin, the wider kin network, really do become persona non grata after the end of 1773. They are, at the time of the Tea Party, they're in exile in the island fortress in the middle of the harbor, Castle William. Threats are published in the papers if they dare show their faces in town. One of the things that his life shows us, I think, that we too often forget, is that our revolution is a violent birth for this country, not a war of ideas on paper alone, but also a war in the streets. And one man's tea party was another man's terror, and for Copley's kin, it was terror. House attacks by night, and particular kinds of yells, and stone throwing, and tar and feathering, and Copley's kin was on the brunt of it, even though they were not people of strong political loyalties. They really were, like most people, thinking quite pragmatically about self-interest, and they bet wrong.
And then they had to leave.
Copley left Boston in June of 1774, 10 days after the so-called intolerable acts, including the Boston Port Act, closed the port. So he got out while he could. He left his entire family behind, walked away from them all, I think, not knowing on which side of the ocean they would or should reunite. You know, he left with the idea of going from the edge of this empire into its center, and it seems pretty clear that it was always his hope that he would make it in the big city, which of course was London. So he said in later life, he says, you know, I left long before the war broke out, not for political reasons, you know, before anyone could have anticipated what happened, for the purpose of studying art. This is both true and false.
So looking here at at these paintings again and the descriptions that go along with them, I noticed that, and it's not just here at the Harvard Art Museums, but everywhere where Copley's hang, underneath the name John Singleton Copley, it says American.
Yeah.
Would he have quibbled with that? Because you were talking about how we've laid claim to him.
I think he meant, certainly at the time he left, he meant American in the way that we would speak of being from New England. So that it's a regional identity. One would certainly have used it in Jamaica as well as in Massachusetts. In the world of his birth, British American hyphenated would have been a common term into the Seven Years' War. So American as a collective identity is sort of coming into being in these years in the 1760s, which proved to be such problematic years for somebody like Copley, who is attached to the seamless British world of his birth. So he might have called himself regionally an American. He had enough foresight at the time he left to believe that the Americans, who he begins referring to as people over there, that the Americans would win. So he knows that they are taking on a sort of proto-national identity, and if there is war, they will not back down, because he has seen them not back down.
For decades prior to
for a good decade. Yeah. He has seen the world of the middle ground, which is the place where a tradesman lives, right? Just fall away like a trapdoor opening. And I think what American comes to mean winds up on one side of that trapdoor, and the sort of British American falls through it, and he winds up as a British artist.
Now, you call it, the subtitle of your book is A Revolution in Color.
In color, which I mean in two ways. One, of course, is the color trades, but I also want us to see the revolution in more shades of color than we often do, not with white-hatted patriots and black-hatted Tories doing combat over an obvious set of divisions. The divisions emerge, they're not obvious, and there are many people like Copley, in fact, probably most people, in the uneasy middle between those two sides.
So now, of course, we have to ask. I mean, we're having this conversation after there's been this massive political act, transformation. Yeah. Some people are even calling it a revolution with the presidential election. I mean,
I think that the world probably felt something like this to Copley, where there's a sudden sea change that seems to demand a new level of side choosing, and where the future is very unclear. You know, Copley's America did not have robust democratic institutions. Democracy was, for most people in his place and time, an insult. But the idea of the temperature of life suddenly going from a sustainable 98.6 to 105 degrees, I think would have been very familiar after, you know, I think the Tea Party really is the moment where there is no turning back. John Adams in his diary calls the Tea Party famously, you know, so bold, so intrepid that it cannot be but seen as an epoca in history. A sentence after that, he says, there are many people who would like to see as many bodies floating face down in the harbor as there are chests of tea. And he was talking about Copley's father-in-law. So a world that seems polite and then bursts into a new level of vitriol, I think is very much how that moment felt to Copley.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us here at the Harvard Art Museums about John Singleton Copley, and I mean, look, what goes around comes around in history. We can never learn about it enough, I think. So
yeah, well,
you.
The problem is that we can only live forward, and historians can only see backwards. So here we are facing forward into an uncertain future, just as everybody who we ever study does, and it's humbling to remember that.
Jane Kamensky is a professor of history at Harvard. And her new book is A Revolution in Color, The World of John Singleton Copley. That's it for today and this week. Have a happy, healthy, and safe holiday season. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.